This program is a presentation of UCTV for educational and non-commercial use only.
Basic research in chemistry and nanotechnology combine to counter terror threats. Meet one of America's newest astronaut candidates. Get an update on California's bold initiative to encourage technological innovation. And explore how science understands why materials behave the way they do. All on this episode of On Beyond.
Nerve gas attacks, bombs aboard jetliners, anthrax in our mail. These are the new realities of American life. How do we detect these hidden threats? What new technologies are available to help safeguard us during America's new war on terrorism? Here at UCSD, researchers are applying fundamental knowledge in chemistry to create portable sensors capable of detecting nerve gas. They've also created glowing nanowires that can detect the presence of TNT from a handprint. It's all part of an effort to use basic research to create inexpensive portable devices that can detect otherwise invisible chemical and biological hazards.
Events of September 11 really provided a sharp focus for our research effort. And the issues there are to be able to detect chemical, biological warfare agents, explosives with very high precision, very low false alarm rate, and very inexpensively, so we could build some small devices that could be deployed everywhere, be very cheap, and be able to provide a continuous stream of information to people like the first responders, the police and fire department officials, to tell people what's happening and where it's happening.
The advantage of using a low-power, miniaturized electronic sensor is that you could deploy it remotely, with a wireless monitoring system. So for example, you could have an early warning detection system for toxic vapors such as nerve agents. The military, for example, would be interested in having a sensor you could put around a troop emplacement that would tell you if a toxic cloud were coming in your facility, so you'd have advance warning. Another potential application would be for detecting explosive vapors, and you could have just a handheld sensor, or if you were looking for something such as mines, you might want to deploy it robotically, where you would have the sensor or TNT sniffer mounted on a robot that you could send out into a field to search for mines, so that if an accident were to occur, the only damage would be to a robot.
The instrument we've been developing over the last 9 years basically measures the size and composition of individual particles on a continuous basis. What we've been using it for is measuring pollution all over the world and determining the sources of particles of particular health concerns. But in theory, you could, since it detects each individual particle or the chemical composition of each individual particle, you could use it out in a natural environment on a continuous basis to detect particles, potentially bacteria particles, that are present on an instantaneously, instead of after the fact going in and figuring out whether whether they're present or not, so that you could use it as sort of a preventative or an early warning type device. What it is it's an instrument that's mounted on a cart with wheels, so it's transportable, it can move anywhere. And what it does is it's constantly drawing the sample into the system. They are basically tracked through a tracking device that detects each individual particle and tells us their size. And then we can do the chemical analysis of each sized particle and get the exact chemical makeup of that particle. The size is really critical because it gives you a couple of things. One is it narrows down the source a little bit further. Mechanically generated species like soil dust. Those have the exact same size, for instance, as bacteria. So alone, you wouldn't be able to tell from the size, but the size also tells you where it's going to settle in your body, so it's a really important parameter to have. The composition is determined subsequently after you have the size. That's what really nails the different sort of tracers, chemical markers within the particle could be used to discriminate between a soil particle and a bacteria particle.
The events of the September 11 really provided some focus for the types of problems that people we would like to be able to deal with. Also, the Tokyo subway bombing gave us some other examples. Let's start with the Tokyo subway bombing. There were a lot of people who were sick, lying on the ground. They didn't know why they were lying on the ground, why they were unconscious, why they were dead. And so the first responders, the emergency personnel coming in, they didn't know what they were facing. They didn't know if it was cyanide, sarin, just a bunch of people who are getting sick from, you know, something they ate for breakfast, or if it was something that's actually present in the subway. And so you need to have something that can go in there and figure out what's there. The anthrax scare that we've had more recently, there you've got something that's happening over a longer period of time. And if you had something that would detect immediately that there's an envelope and this powder is anthrax, then you don't have to go tracing things out. Now, you know, it's a total mess. If you've got somebody who's handled one letter that's got anthrax on it, gets onto other letters and those go everywhere, then, you know, it's really difficult to track it down once it's already been disseminated. Being able to determine very quickly what you have and what it's capable of doing, you know, is it floating on the air, is it in the water, is it something people are just going to touch and get sick that way, is very important. And to kind of illustrate some of the challenges we have for sensors is you kind of back off and say, well, what are the things that people use to protect themselves against these kinds of agents? You know, for instance, you go into a doctor's office and most doctors will be wearing masks, you know, these little surgical masks that are little, just a piece of filter. And this protects you from a lot of things. It can protect you from airborne particulate matter, things like anthrax, which has a particle size on the order of about 1 to 10 microns, can be filtered out with a mask like that. A detector for something like that has to find a particle, has to be able to hopefully collect it and capture it, and then either determine right away what it is, an anthrax spore, for instance, or hold it for a later time, so then you can go analyze it and say, okay, this is anthrax, and it's got this kind of strain associated with it, and so that's what we're going to have to be looking for in the field. Then if you talk about chemical agents, molecules are much smaller than spores, and so typically this is a mask that you can buy at Home Depot that is used in the pesticide industry. If you're spraying pesticides, which are essentially nerve agents for bugs, you have to have something a little bit more than just a powdered filter to take that out. And the filter cartridges that they have in these masks are look like filters, but they also have chemicals inside them. This is one of the filter cartridges for the pesticides. And they have a cartridge inside here is a chemical that absorbs small molecules, pesticides or whatever chemicals, paint thinner, things that you don't want to be breathing. And so to be able to filter out a chemical, you have to have something that's a lot more sophisticated, a little bit more complicated, and much smaller. And that's true in the sensor area too. And it's kind of an irony that it's a lot harder to determine something like anthrax than it is to determine something like sarin. Sarin gas is a chemical warfare agent. It's a small molecule, and it can be absorbed by something like this. There are chemical tools or instruments that we have that can identify sarin very easily and very quickly, you know, large bench scale apparatus. Of course, our research goal is to shrink that bench scale or a room size piece of apparatus into something that's the size of a chip. The lab here is a nanotechnology lab, and we develop devices based on nanoscale materials, things that are very small. And what we'd like to do is take something like the size of a research lab or an analytical lab or a forensic laboratory, the size of a room, and shrink it down onto something that can fit onto a computer chip that might be able to fit inside a cell phone or fit into a small calculator, some handheld or low-power, battery-powered device. And so the challenges in the research field are to develop materials that will be able to do all of these very sophisticated analytical applications in a very small space. For instance, if you're looking for a disease in somebody, you have to sample their blood, for instance. You have to clean it up. You have to extract maybe some DNA from some bacterium that you might find in that blood and then analyze it and figure out what it is and then report back. And so all of those functions can be done in a giant laboratory, and that's how, when you're diagnosed with an illness, typically that's how it's done. There's a large machine that sits on a benchtop and a bunch of people walking around and moving samples from place to place. So we'd like to do is develop the tools that can do that all in a very small factory that's built on the top of a computer chip. The tools that we have developed to build these small computer chips are the same tools we're going to be using to build these little laboratories on a chip. And you know what the computer industry will do is they'll take one of those chips and they'll place it onto a ceramic package. That's a single chip there. And then wire it all up so it has a bunch of different wires coming out, and then this thing gets plugged into the computer board. That's it. So what we want to do is put a laboratory into that that has all the functions, capabilities of a research laboratory, but could be this small or even smaller. And some of the things that we've been working on to get there are we start with silicon. So this little patch right now, this on this piece of silicon, is tuned chemically to change from green to red when it sees a chemical agent. What we'd like to do is take this. Now, this is obviously really big. It's easy to see. It's easy for us to work with in the lab. Ultimately, we're going to be shrinking this thing down under the size of one of these individual transistors on a chip and have many of these different devices sitting on one chip. So, in other words, you don't want to be able to wheel in your device that just detects anthrax or just detects sarin. You want to have a device that goes in and detects if there's air pollution, if there's sarin, if there's cyanide, anthrax, any of the number of other potential biological agents, if there are viruses in the air, that just cold viruses. And being able to have that capability built all on a chip so that you can do all of those assays at once is kind of our goal, and that's what we focus our research on. You've seen Star Trek, where they have these guys come down and land on a planet, and they pull out some little box, and they can determine everything about their environment and where the bad guys are and who's getting sick and where they need to be taking them. That's what we'd like to be able to do. That's a vision, is to, if you can do all these capabilities on a chip. I mean, right now you can carry around a cell phone that looks a lot like the little communicators that they use. What if you plugged into that cell phone some chemical detectors or biological detectors as well? Then everybody wearing a cell phone is now a roving analytical lab as well. And so some of the things that we've been focusing on, our efforts on, are to try to take these nanotechnology devices and put them into packages that would be able to be used like these tricorder, little scientific devices that these science fiction guys work with. This is not science fiction. This is actually a device that we developed for detection of sarin. This box here has a fan. It sucks air in. Air comes through out the back here. One of these chips that I just showed you is sitting right up here. And as the air goes over the chip, if the chip sees, the chip was tuned in that case chemically to see sarin, if the chip sees sarin, it turns a color, and then we read the signal out of the box. This is a box that was built to do live agent testing on sarin. We took boxes similar to this one to Aberdeen Proving Grounds back in March of 2000 to suck up sarin and see if we could see it. And the really nice thing about that was one of our main goals in that project has been, we don't want to have any false alarms. We want to tune the chemistry of these materials so that when they trigger, it's sarin or whatever you're looking for. Because you don't want people stampeding out of a football stadium when, somebody drops a bottle of perfume in the hallway. And so we were successful in doing that. When we took these chips there, they responded, triggered on sarin. We test them in the lab and other places. They're really stable because of the catalytic reaction we build into these things. They're really stable and behave themselves unless they see the agent. And that's kind of one of the goals that you have for the nanotechnology areas, that develop these tools that will allow you to do things that you'd really like to do. What else you have to have inside here is a little spectrometer. It's that benchtop spectrometer I was talking about that you want to shrink down into the size of a gumball. How do you do that? Well, most people are walking around with a benchtop spectrometer sitting on their belts right now. It's a CD player. And this is a cheap CD player. We pulled the guts of this thing apart. When we first started working on this project, we realized that what we needed was what's inside a CD player, because it's got just a very small optical read head that reads the light coming off of a CD, and that's how your CD gets read. And inside that device, there's a small laser, and there's a small detector, and it rides over on your, along on your CD player and reads out the data. Instead of having it read the data off a CD player, we wanted to focus this laser beam on one of our silicon wafers and bounce it off and take the spectrum from that. And you know, this proves that you can do this thing. You can make spectrometers really small if you desire to do so. And so ours wasn't quite so nice and pretty, but this is what we built for our sarin detector. And it's a lot like the CD player. It has a little light source, a little mini laser. And then there's a little window here. The sample chip would sit right up here. And these are two photo detectors. And so the light bounces off the surface, and this is a little splitter that then takes the light back, and it comes into either detector and allows us to make the measurement and take a spectrum of light right off of the chip. And there's some electronics back here that provide signal processing, really rudimentary signal processing, to be able to send the signal out to a reader.
The way we initially got into this sort of research was Mike Saylor and I were just talking over coffee one day on ways that you might be able to detect nerve agents such as sarin. And we had been working for a number of years on catalysts that would detoxify nerve agents and phosphate esters in general. These catalysts, what they do is they promote the rapid reaction of water with the nerve agent, and they then break one of the key bonds to the nerve agent and turn it into a harmless species. And since Mike's work on porous silicon using interferometric methods was able to detect hydrofluoric acid, we thought that the broad class of nerve agents that contain fluorine, the most well-known one being sarin, would be amenable to this approach. We've been working in our laboratory on the synthesis of polysilols, or silicon wire polymers is the way you can think of them, that are the ultimate nanowire of silicon, in that they contain a single chain of silicon atoms surrounded by an organic sheath. So this is analogous to a conventional wire where you have the metal in the center and an insulating area of organic material surrounding it. These wires, though, aren't going to be used to conduct electricity. They're going to be used to conduct excited state energy, which we can provide by exciting them with an ultraviolet lamp. The excited electron runs along the nanowire of silicon atoms, and when it returns to the ground state, it emits green light. However, in the presence of an electron-accepting molecule such as TNT, that organic explosive material binds to the organic insulating layer around the silicon wire and grabs that excited electron before it can emit the green light. So basically, it short-circuits the luminescence, or it turns the green emission off in the presence of TNT. Now, for example, that can be used in a simple process to visualize traces of TNT residue. We've done cases where we take a lab glove and put a little bit of TNT on the surface of the glove and then completely clean the surface of the lab glove so that no TNT residue is visible to the naked eye. Yet there are nanogram quantities of TNT that remain contaminating the surface of that glove. If you then touch a piece of paper with that glove, then if you illuminate the area with ultraviolet light while spraying on a very dilute solution of these silicon nanowires, the nanowires give off their characteristic green luminescence in the presence of the ultraviolet light. But wherever a small residue of a TNT particle is present, that quenches that green luminescence so that you see a black picture on a green luminescent background. And so a handprint develops if you spray this contaminated area, where you can clearly visualize the hand that was contaminated with TNT versus the one that wasn't. One way this might be used would be to screen things such as subway tickets. So, for example, if a terrorist who who had been making a bomb from TNT, even though he had thought he had cleaned his hands, there would be minute residues of TNT left behind. And if he touched a BART ticket and we were to coat it with this luminescent film, this could be visualized even at the resolution of obtaining a fingerprint from it.
It's been interesting to see how this has rapidly developed and the sort of applications that are not only coming out of Mike Saylor and Bill Trogler's lab, but also out of the Division of Physical Sciences in general. Post-September 11th, there's been a lot of changes in what people do in their laboratories in terms of trying to develop the technology for detections. It's interesting to see that there's a lot of analogy with the 1950s and 1960s when we were in the Cold War and people were trying to develop technologies not only for offensive weapons but also for detection. And it's exactly the same case now, except that it's even more complex in terms of what the possible agents are. In the case of the nuclear, you knew. In the case of the biological and chemical, you don't necessarily know. So emerging technologies like this get to be critical. Positive spin on this, though, is that in a case such as in the 1950s, we developed techniques for detecting cesium-137, strontium-90, and that led to major advances in understanding climatology, meteorology, and ocean circulation. A lot of the techniques now are going to be used in the biotechnology firms, in the biotechnology world, in terms of new detection techniques, understanding things at the genomic level.
Megan, thank you very much for joining us. Would you give us a little insight into your background, your childhood?
Sure. I come from a Navy family. My father was a career naval officer. He was a naval aviator, so we moved all over the world growing up. I have two older sisters and a baby brother, so that was a unique experience and a unique way to grow up.
Do any of your siblings share your technical or scientific interests or exploits?
Well, they both work in technical and medical fields. My younger brother's still in high school, so he's not quite sure what he's going to do yet. But my sister Erin studied biology in school and now works in the medical field. My sister Shannon works for a company that exports electronics to Japan, but they work more in sales and marketing side of things.
How did you come to pursuing science or the technical fields? Were you always interested as a child? Did you have any particular inspiration, teachers, or?
No, I think that as a young girl, I was always fascinated by airplanes. Like I said, my father was a pilot. So as a very young girl, I used to think that's what I wanted to do when I grew up, was be a pilot like my daddy. And I think that in high school, I certainly enjoyed maths and sciences, but I didn't have a particular field of interest until I decided to go to college and study aerospace engineering. I knew that I was interested in the space program. Whether or not that meant becoming an astronaut, I wasn't sure, but I certainly was very interested always in space exploration.
Was it at this time when you had this fascination with flight or that you thought about being an astronaut? Is it the same kind of childish wonder, you know, boy, I'd like to go into space?
I think certainly that's where it started. My family maintains that it's something I talked about as a very young girl. And certainly, I think, like you said, all children dream about, wow, wouldn't that be cool to be an astronaut? I know that I started thinking about it as a real dream in high school and saying that that's what I wanted to do. And that's, I think, why one of the reasons I went towards aerospace engineering. But I think at that time I really thought, well, this is not something that just anybody can do. And I just wanted to be connected with it no matter what. And I think it probably wasn't until I neared the end of my undergraduate work that I started to think about it as, you know, I could maybe really do this. And started to look into how to go about doing it.
You're doing research here at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the Marine Physical Laboratory, which seems to be a far stretch from going into space. What is your research? What do you do here at Scripps?
I study shallow water acoustics. I study how sound propagates underwater and what we can learn about the ocean environment from that. I don't think that it's that big of a stretch, quite honestly, from oceanography to aerospace. They're both environments that are hostile to people, that it's not easy to survive and explore them. And I think that the challenges that are inherent in both fields appealed to me.
When you seriously consider the possibility that maybe I could be an astronaut, did you do anything in particular special to plan a course of study, focus?
It seemed to me that the majority of civilian astronauts had PhDs in the sciences, and so I started to, I'd thought about that anyway, going on to get a master's degree in engineering, so I started to seriously think about PhD programs, and at that time I started to talk to people about what that was like, what it was like to go on to get a doctorate. I had the opportunity to meet Kathy Sullivan, and one of the things that she told me that stuck with me was that if you're going to go on to do doctorate research, you need to choose something that you love doing no matter what happens in your life. You need to choose a path that, you know, if you're not going to get into the space program, you're still going to enjoy doing this research because the odds of getting into the space program are pretty slim. So I started to think about my options, and at the time I'd become involved in an engineering project called the Human Powered Submarine Races. I'd built a submarine with some fellow engineers and really fell in love with ocean engineering and the just the cutting edge technology that was being explored in that field. And so I started to look at the different ocean engineering and oceanography programs and discovered the program here, the Applied Ocean Sciences program here, and really liked what they were doing here and started to look into the different fields of study that were available here.
Do you think that your line of training, your specialized education, helped your being chosen as an astronaut?
Well, I certainly wouldn't claim to know what goes on in the mind of the selection board. But I do think that there are parallels, as I said, between oceanography and between aerospace exploration, simply because it is so difficult to conduct research at sea. So there are probably parallels between the two that may have helped. I think in general that having some kind of operational experience, meaning working with hardware, deploying instruments, scuba diving certainly, I know is part of the training for astronauts. So I think that there probably are a few things in there that were appealing, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Very few people on the planet are ever going to go through this process. Can you give us a sense of what takes in the application and the selection process?
Sure. NASA basically accepts applications on a continuing basis. And every 2 years, at least this is the way the program is structured now, every 2 years they set a deadline. So in July of last year, July 1999, there was a deadline for submitting your applications for consideration for this year's class. They review those applications. They get a couple thousand of them, and they review those applications and then ask a few hundred people, maybe 300 people, to get flight physicals. And I think that's just to verify your basic physical fitness in terms of eyesight, that kind of thing. Then they invite about 120 people out to Houston for a week of interviews, 20 people at a time. So in September, I was invited out for that week. There were 20 of us. And it's largely medical exams. You go through a week of fairly rigorous physical tests and some psychological and psychiatric tests and interviews, and then an interview with the selection board. And they interviewed people from September through February this year. And they also do a federal background investigation on you. And so I found out in March that I was having a background investigation conducted on me, and then it was waiting to hear what their selection would be.
So that interview with the selection board must have been one of the final or the final interviews. Are you allowed to tell us anything about it? What was it like? Were
sure.
there other astronauts on the board?
Mm-hmm.
Was it it's doctors and
probably
a range of people?
Probably two-thirds astronauts, I would say, and then other directors of the various programs at the Space Center. It was really fun, actually. There were probably a dozen people there. There might be 18 or 20 people on the board, but only a dozen of them were there for me. And basically, you talk about yourself. It's not a technical interview in that sense. They just want to know about your experiences, what you've done. They'll interrupt you and ask you to tell more about a certain story. So really, I mean, you're the expert on yourself, and so in that sense, it was a lot of fun. And it was really neat just to be in a room with a lot of those people.
In that final discussion, that interview, did you ever get any idea that you may have been selected or that you were...
No, not really. Certainly I left the room thinking, oh, that was fun, I did a good job, you know, I presented a good case and told them all about myself. And then 5 minutes later you're thinking, oh gosh, I could have said this instead, and why didn't I answer this way? That would have been so much better. So really, I mean, a lot of people, they sort of keep their cards close to their chest. They don't, they didn't really give you a sense one way or the other, which makes sense. I wouldn't expect them to. And honestly, the people that I interviewed with, I mean, these people, they're tremendous. They've done so many things. They're so much experience, so well educated, from such a diverse background that really it's hard to look at these other people and say, oh, sure, they're gonna pick me up over all these people. So not really a sense that it was going to be me.
That is really amazing. In my experience working with people in administration of NASA and people in the field in NASA, different space centers, that the degree of professionalism and the level of education and dedication is truly unparalleled. It's interesting that the field gets narrowed down rather quickly from 2,000 to hundreds to a fraction of hundreds and then to a few tens of people. If you don't make it through the final interview or you aren't selected at that point, are you allowed to go back and apply again for another round?
I believe they ask everyone to update their applications on a yearly basis, and they keep all of the applications in a pool, and they are considered every time they go through the selection process.
So you had your final interview, the fun interview in the fall, and recently you were notified. How were you notified, and what was the first thought?
Well, I was notified by telephone. I was phoned by a fellow called Bill Parsons, who is the Center Operations Director at Johnson Space Center. And I just started laughing. That was my only reaction. I just started laughing. And I shut my office door, and I said, well, I need to sit down. And he said, well, let me give you a second to collect yourself. And I just laughed. I was surprised, thrilled, didn't know what to say.
Just a giddy, happy.
Absolutely.
Ridiculous laugh. That must be amazing. You had just been selected to what is undoubtedly one of the most elite group of human beings on the planet, people who are going possibly to venture into space. You're going to be facing some incredible tasks, some very demanding work, and be put in some very dangerous situations, albeit controlled, but there's the element of danger. Did you have any of those thoughts? What was going through your mind after you collected yourself, after you sat down and stopped laughing for a bit?
I think, honestly, on some level, I think it hasn't really hit me yet. Certainly, I think about the things that you've mentioned, and I have thought about them for years, that this is a tremendous opportunity. I really look forward to the challenges that will be involved in training, and then hopefully when I get a chance someday to train for space flight and then actually go. But it's one of those things that it's just so, it's hard to get your head around it, really. I think my thoughts still are just so thrilled that to have the opportunity, really looking forward to meeting the challenges.
What do you personally want to do as an astronaut?
Well, I really hope I have the opportunity to go to the space station. I live on the space station for a while. Also have the opportunity to conduct an EVA, extravehicular activity. That would be tremendous. I also, one of the things that I've enjoyed doing here as a graduate student and prior to that as an undergraduate student is outreach work to the community, promoting science education for children and for secondary schoolers. I think that's very important, and I hope that in this role I'll have that opportunity maybe to open up some doors for some young people.
In terms of becoming an astronaut, what do you do now? What are the next few steps? Where are you going in the next couple of weeks?
Well, in about 2 weeks, I leave for Pensacola, Florida, and I'm going to be going through water survival training in preparation for some military flight training that will take place later on. Then we'll be oriented at Houston at the Johnson Space Center. We will travel around a little bit to some of the various NASA installations. We'll go through some land survival training, and then I'll begin military flight training in Pensacola, I think towards the end of September. And after that, I'm not sure.
Is it true that you will learn to fly a jet?
Well, the flight training that I'll be doing in Pensacola will be in the T-34s, which is the Navy prop trainer, same plane that my dad learned to fly, so that'll be really neat. My understanding is that the mission specialist astronauts and astronaut candidates fly backseat in the T-38, which is a single engine jet trainer. I don't believe we'll be trained to actually pilot it, though.
Have you ever piloted an airplane? Are you looking forward?
I have a private pilot's license that I have been working on. I got in February and been flying for about a year now, and it's awesome. I love it. It's a lot of fun, so I'm looking forward to doing some more intensive training.
Did you get your private license after starting the application process for being an astronaut, one of those things you were doing? Or?
It's something that I've always wanted to have the opportunity to do, and I started doing it about a year, a little over a year ago, so before I put the application in, but I think that probably having some experience, some exposure to flight training is a good idea.
Besides doing your job perfectly, doing everything right, conducting interesting research, what is there anything you dream about or think about or want to experience the most by being in space, going into space?
Well, I suppose there's the very obvious answer of I can't wait to look back and see the Earth from out there. I think there has to be few experiences that could equal that.
In high school, in your secondary education, you started to think, gee, I'd like to be an astronaut. Maybe I could do that. If a 15-year-old told you that she or he wanted to become an astronaut and wanted to start planning to do that, what advice or counsel would you give to someone in secondary schools?
I think that's about the age that I started to think about it. I think one of the most important things that I've learned since then is that it's hard to make any one plan and stick with it. There are a lot of different ways to get here. People take a lot of different paths. And I think the most important thing is to not be afraid to go down some of the different roads that are going to open up to you. You need to find something that you love doing and be the best that you possibly can be at it. So there isn't one particular major that you need to think about going into in college. Certainly, you need to be a scientist or you need to have the operational background of being in the military, at least at this point. So I think if the teenager had an interest in science, then it would be finding what field of science really appeals to you and being the best that you can be at that. And also just live your life. Experience as many different things as you can, because it's not just the ability that you have on paper in terms of your education, but the experiences that you've had in life and how you get along with other people and what you can contribute to a group situation.
If a 5-year-old were to ask you the same question, what would you say?
Well, I would tell a 5-year-old, I think a way to determine if you have an interest in science is to ask a lot of questions. Their parents probably wouldn't like that, but ask a lot of questions about how something works, why it works the way it does. I think that we have a tendency to just accept things at face value, flip a switch and the light comes on. But I think that the way to explore an interest in science is to ask, well, how does that happen? Why does it happen? And to start thinking about science at that level. Science is a lot of fun. It can be like a game for kids. An exploratory game, and kids love it when you approach science that way in an experimental fashion. And I think that would be the way to spark an interest in science, to think about why the world is the way it is when you look around you.
You've been selected to take an active role and be at the very leading edge of one of the most ambitious and adventurous enterprises that humanity's ever undertaken, stepping off the planet, so to speak. At this point, what do you hope to accomplish as an astronaut? What contribution do you hope you could make to that enterprise?
I think my role would be really as part of the team, being the best team member that I can be to help the program as a whole achieve its goals. I think that astronauts are trained as generalists, and you need to have the ability to be a lot of different things, play a lot of different roles, and I hope that through this training and from my background that I'll have the ability to contribute in that way.
You bring up a very good point, and we tend to forget it, that space travel, space exploration isn't only just the astronauts, and that's a very big and important part, but there are many hundreds and thousands of people behind every hour, every
Absolutely.
Minute, every second of work that goes on in space. And that's an enterprise which takes in really the whole society and our culture in a way, because we're making the decision to do that. What do you dream that the whole enterprise of human space exploration may contribute, may accomplish?
That's a big question. I think that I think it's in our nature to explore. I think it's always been in our nature to explore and to push the boundaries of what we think we can know and what we think we can achieve. And I think that the space program for me symbolizes in a lot of ways that continued drive for exploration, that continued need to push the boundaries of of who we are and what we can know. And I think that beyond that, certainly the practical advances that are required, the technical advances that are required to support this kind of endeavor, certainly have many, many benefits back here on Earth in medical sciences and in computer sciences and all of the areas of the exploration that are going on here on the Earth.
When you get to Houston and you meet your other classmates and your colleagues, is there anything you'd like to say then? What would you first say to them?
I'm just happy to be here. Hope I can help the ball club.
Well, Megan, thank you very much for joining us today. I really look forward to following your career. I hope you would come back to us in a couple of years, or when you're out of your training.
Sure.
And we look forward to hearing your name on a manifest and hearing you go up on the shuttle and
thank you.
Be on the space station.
Thank you very much.
These centers of science and innovation will not just be portals to the new economy, they will be the pilots of the new economy.
December 2000, Governor Gray Davis outlines a bold vision, creating four California Institutes of Science and Innovation. Their mandate, keep California, its economy, its jobs, on the cutting edge of tomorrow's technologies. 1 year later, CalIT Squared, the California Institute for Telecommunications and Information Technology, is doing just that. On the campuses of UC San Diego and UC Irvine, research is now underway on the technologies that will revolutionize the Internet and wireless communications 3, 7, even 10 years into the future.
The governor tapped into some very productive, unused resources.
Institute Director Larry Smarr's interdisciplinary vision for CalIT Squared.
Bring people together from the university sector in novel ways, getting Irvine faculty to work with San Diego faculty, getting computer scientists to work with artists, bring in engineers and working with chemists.
So compelling is that vision that estimated total funds raised over 4 years could jump from $300 million when CalIT Squared was launched to nearly $500 million, 5 times the $100 million pledged by the state of California to build CalIT Square buildings and laboratories. Construction on UC Irvine's 120,000-square-foot facility, set to begin in early 2002, for occupancy 2 years later. UC San Diego's CalIT Squared building at 250,000 square feet is scheduled for completion in spring 2004. From temporary quarters on both campuses, the Institute is already forging ahead with research projects in areas ranging from new software for wireless networks to intelligent transportation and telematics. Researchers from industry partners, funding agencies, and both campuses held workshops and strategy sessions, jump-starting joint projects such as this one at UC Irvine, involving electric cars for shared use by commuters, cars that could soon be equipped with wireless cameras and other sensors under development at UC San Diego.
CalIT Squared's involvement is very important for this. One of the things that we've done so far and will probably continue to do is using a GPS tracking system so that we always know where the vehicles are located at any given time. And ideally what that's helping us also do is determine what the traffic patterns are for individuals and how they're actually using these vehicles or other vehicles that they might have.
Also in 2001, CalIT Squared launched research sponsored by industry partners, partners such as San Diego-based semiconductor maker AMCC. The company's chief liaison with CalIT Squared says California will be the ultimate beneficiary of the three AMCC-funded projects now underway.
CalIT Squared benefits AMCC through the research we're directly involved in, and with that type of research, we could become leaders in our industry and market space, and AMCC will grow as a company and begin to help support the economy of San Diego, and that will help ensure California's productivity as a state.
Since AMCC and over 40 other companies first pledged support for CalIT Squared, the Institute has added more than half a dozen new members, pushing the total to 50 and counting. Founding partners such as Qualcomm were instrumental in helping the Institute accelerate the build-out of high-speed wireless infrastructure on both campuses, now among the most advanced in the world. Linked to that infrastructure, Cal-IT Squared is testing technologies like this supercomputer-driven visualization system to help study everything from seismic activity to environmental data from wireless sensors deployed at places such as this ecological reserve in northern San Diego County, overseen by San Diego State University, another new Cal-IT Squared partner. Among other year one accomplishments, Cal-IT Squared initiated a fellowship program to attract the best and the brightest student researchers. 22 undergraduates in the summer of 2001, 69 graduate students for the 2001-2002 academic year, 42 at UC San Diego, 27 of them at UC Irvine. The Institute also brought distinguished researchers to both campuses for seminars, short courses, workshops, and symposiums on topics ranging from information theory and non-volatile memory to optics and power amplifiers. Those events streamed live to the World Wide Web and archived for on-demand viewing as Cal-IT Squared embarked on an active outreach mission reflected in extensive coverage in national as well as local media of the Institute's mission to keep California ahead of the nation and the world in key technologies.
California is really making a whole new model here for how to support research, namely that our state is determining what's important for our future.
Right.
We're getting our government, our universities, and our private folks coming together to define that research agenda.
By doing so, says Smar, Cal-IT Squared and its unique brand of interdisciplinary collaboration could yield breakthroughs that drive California's leadership and high-tech jobs well into the next decade.
The main purpose of our study is to really understand what makes the material to behave the way they actually do. We characterize the materials and try to decipher the micromechanisms that are responsible for their mechanical properties and thermal properties and failure mechanisms. We have been testing materials all the way from metals and the alloys of these materials to concrete. We have done similar tests on polymeric composite materials. A more recent effort has been on what we call ionic polymer metal composites. We have tested materials under very slow deformations, maybe 10 to the minus 4 per second, which is very slow, to very, very high rate deformation. We test these materials from liquid nitrogen temperature to about 1300 degrees Celsius. We had to develop some very novel experimental techniques where we can subject the material to a history of loading under controlled conditions and then take the material, the test sample, and dissect it to see what has happened to the microstructure. And once you understand that, then one can develop models that can predict the behavior. And then these models can be used by designers in their computer codes to simulate various components of that material, various components that they make out of that material. Essentially, all our instruments have been developed at UCSD. They were designed at UCSD, they have been constructed at UCSD, and most of them are novel in many ways.
I'm developing a model for the high strain rate response of concrete, and as part of that work, I have to do tests on the concrete at high strain rates, and that's what we have this device for, the Hopkinson bar. The Hopkinson bar is designed to do very high strain rates, up in this case about 100 per second, but in smaller cases going up to 10,000 per second. This is the concrete sample we're going to test. It's basically a two-phase material of mortar and concrete, and it's composed of many materials. But basically what we're going to do is we're going to take this, put it between the Hopkinson bar, and smash it. A large projectile goes down through this barrel, impacts the incident bar, which in the elastic wave travels through here, loads a sample in this region, and we measure the strain in the bar, in the incident bar, in the transmitted bar, and from that we can find what the stress and strain response is at high strain rates. And I'm just going to kind of squeeze these together, make sure everything's well held together well, and place a shield over it. Is everybody ready? Firing, 3, 2, 1. That's what it is. So I'm going to walk down here and we'll take a look at the damage. I don't know if you remember what the sample looked like before. It looks a little different now. It's been completely destroyed, more or less. The only thing that might have held it together, in fact, were these rings, which aren't designed to do that. But that's what happened in this case. And you can see the concrete's basically turned to dust. These are the results from the test we just shot. The whole test took about 1 millisecond from start to finish. And over here, the first part of this orange graph, this is proportional to the velocity of the striker bar. After the sample's been loaded, this orange is proportional to the strain rate in the sample. And if we integrate the strain rate over time, we can calculate the strain in the sample. The purple is proportional to the stress in the sample. And once we integrate the strain rate to find the strain, and we have the stress, we know the complete stress-strain history of the sample. And that's what we're looking for.
We have done some work on measuring the dynamic fracture toughness of materials that have been used for the manned module of the space station. These are made out of special aluminum. And the question is, if a meteorite impacts the module at a high velocity and creates a hole, would the pressure vessel explode, or would it sustain the impact? To study that, we had to measure the dynamic fracture toughness of the material. The usual knife is made out of a high-strength steel plate, where you have a plate of certain thickness, and you cut two wedges off of it, and you create a knife like that. Now, if you drive this knife at a very high velocity on a plate, it makes a lip, and that's not what we want. We want to have a controlled experiment where we can create, essentially instantaneously, a notch in a pressure vessel of a certain size. My colleague, John Isaacs, designed and constructed a double-edged knife where instead of cutting the wedges off in this direction, we cut it into the plate. And when optimally designed, if you drive this double-edged knife now at a high velocity onto the plate, it creates a beautiful notch with little cracks at the end. So when the test is done in an actual pressure vessel in a gas gun chamber, then if this crack length is supercritical, the pressure vessel would explode. If it is subcritical, nothing happens. And by taking it to the limit, we can identify experimentally the dynamic fracture toughness of the material.
This is an impact of a penetrator, tungsten heavy metal alloy penetrator, to a piece of alumina target, ballistic grade, dimensions 4 by 4 inches by a half inch thick. The velocity of the penetrator is around 1,000 meters per second. The step between each image is about 4 microseconds, which is 1/250,000th of a second. What we're seeing is the projectile moving and finally contacting over here. We see the first impact as it barely touches. This is pretty remarkable because this must be within a millionth of a second of the time that the projectile impacts. And here we see the projectile going in and the splash, as they call it, coming back. This is alumina and it's mixed with some parts of the projectile. We see it here. It just continues. You can measure these angles and get more information. You can actually measure the velocity of the splash. And the research we're doing indicates that by treating the surface of the ceramic, we can improve its ballistic properties. So This bright spot, we think it's actually the sabot, which carries the projectile down the barrel, burning in the atmosphere as it's getting hot.
The usual microelectronic machines are really very small, minute machine consisting of classical shafts and gears and things like that. But it's a classical concept, but created in a very small scale using the modern technology. And they have tremendous applications in a variety of medical and other areas. Now, this is the next generation of actuator sensors. Here we have a strip of ionic polymer metal composite, which consists of an ionomer plated on both faces with a noble metal, in this case is platinum, and plated on top of that about a couple of microns of gold. In the hydrated state, if you apply a voltage across this strip, a small voltage, about 1 volt, it would move. If you move it, it would create a millivolt voltage across it. So I'm going to show you now. I have here a little box which can create alternating potential. And you can hear that. And I'm going to turn it on, and you can see the polymer wiggles at the same frequency of the applied voltage. Now, if we wiggle this at that frequency, then we actually create a voltage. So it is a soft actuator and sensor altogether. And this actuating and sensing occurs at the molecular level, at the nanoscale, at sub-nanoscale. The polymer itself consists of a fluorocarbon, which is like Teflon, it's hydrophobic, and carries on its structure sulfonates, which are hydrophilic. And the combination creates a microstructure consisting of interconnected clusters. Within the clusters are sulfonates and water. And so when you apply the voltage across it, the neutralizing cations, like sodium or lithium, I think in this case it's lithium, they move from one direction to another and actuate the membrane. What we are doing is we're trying to first, number one, to understand the mechanism, the motion itself, and quantify it, measure the properties of the composite itself, and then create models that capture the essential features. And these models must include electrochemomechanical attributes at the molecular scale. I consider that I'm doing teaching almost all the time, either to myself or to my graduate students, to my undergraduate students in the lab, or in the classroom teaching. And I love to do that. I really enjoy it. When I walk to the classroom, it's just remarkable feeling to relate to these young people. And they are really my intellectual partners. And so not only they learn from me at the beginning, but I expect that I would be learning from them by the time they finish. For people who are in engineering, to be elected in the National Academy of Engineering is probably the highest honor. Very few people are elected every year. I consider that as a great honor that my colleagues and peers have reviewed what I have done and have decided to say, well, you know, now you belong to this club. So it is, in fact, I'm very pleased for that. And at the same time, I do my research and go on and be happy.